Hello, and welcome back to the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel's Behind the Headlines podcast. I'm your host, Katie O'Connell. Coming up today, you'll hear from photographer Rick Wood on what it's like to take pictures at Summerfest. Business reporter Agno Philip explores one way neighborhoods can grow. And our Bucks beat writer breaks down this week's NBA draft. Before we reach those stories, Bill Glauber sat down with his colleague Mark Johnson this week. Mark wrote a very compelling story about a particular type of cancer one local woman faced. Here's Bill and Mark with more.
This is Bill Glauber with Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Mark Johnson, who has written a gripping story in Sunday's Milwaukee Journal Sentinel. It's called 10%. It's a gripping fight for life by a young woman with a deadly disease and her doctors. Mark, first of all, give us a sense of this story, 10%. What's it about?
It's about this kind of leukemia that this woman had. And what struck me right off the bat was that it had a very unusual sort of blend of fortune and misfortune with the diagnosis. 90% of the people that get this disease, it's called acute promyelocytic leukemia, 90% of them are cured. The other 10% die within 10 days. So when you get the diagnosis, it's a very worrisome thing. And in this particular case, the woman who received this diagnosis, Bethany Spees, she was so sick when she got it that it looked like she was going to be one of the 10% who don't make it.
And she had a terrific hematologist, Ihab Atala. Can you tell me about him?
Yes. Very nice guy, very intense. She was lucky because he's dealt with this disease a fair number of times, and it's a pretty rare disease. He's a leukemia specialist, and in fact, he had even dealt with it in circumstances somewhat similar to Bethany's. One of the things with patients who have this disease is that they don't want them to start having strokes, because that's the way these patients die. They have strokes. And unfortunately, when Bethany came in, she was having strokes. She had already had at least one.
And it was touch and death. You write very dramatically about this 10-11 day fight against this disease. What stood out to you in that battle for her?
Well, I think the fact that it's 10 days and that the family sort of knew up front that if she could just get past those 10 days, her chances would be very, very good of surviving. That really struck me.
Take us behind the story. How do you hear about something like this?
Well, in this case, I call very often or email with the different hospitals in the area, and they pitch stories to me. In this case, what happened was, if I remember correctly, they were very interested in having me do a story on the doctor. And there were some interesting things about him, sort of more to do, I think, with the research end of things. But the PR person who mentioned this doctor knows that I really like people stories. I like there to be a patient, and I like kind of those dramatic medical stories. And she happened to know that there was one that went along with this doctor that he'd been involved in. It's sort of a function of once you've been around long enough in a community, and I'm sure you know this, Bill, but people learn the kinds of stories you like to do, and they sort of help you find them.
And Mark, finally, you're neither a doctor nor a scientist, but many of your stories have either a scientific or medical bent. How are you able to grasp so much material, very technical material, and then make it so important that the person who's not technically gifted will understand what you're writing about?
I guess one of the keys over time I've come to see is that in this profession, ignorance was actually a bit of a strength. I was a terrible math and science student in high school, so bad that I didn't take either of them in college. And what it means is that when I go out and interview people, I have to ask a lot of very basic questions. Sometimes they start the scientists or doctors I talk to start like two or three levels ahead of where I am, and I have to get them down to translating it for me. But once they do, I have a confidence that if I can understand something, then anybody can.
Mark also said he likes to go with the Aunt Edna rule of interviewing doctors. Every doctor has to be able to tell their Aunt Edna what exactly they do for a living. When he asks them questions, he tries to draw out the Aunt Edna answers. For more on this story, including how arsenic was used as a treatment, pick up Sunday's edition of the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel or visit jsonline.com. Moving on, Summerfest started this week. Many people are frequent visitors of the festival, but have you ever seen an act up close? Say, as up close as the people who get to photograph the concerts. Here's Journal Sentinel photographer Rick Wood on some of his favorite Summerfest memories and how he got started shooting the festival.
It actually started because I speak at a couple of journalism workshops and for high school and college students, and I needed an eye-opener for my presentation. So I went and said, well, I'll go cover some bands at Summerfest and then put a two-minute show together of what's popular. And I didn't even know who the bands were. So I went to Marcus Amphitheater, and I went in and said, hey, I'm here from the Journal. I need to photograph this kid named Justin Bibler, you know. And they looked at me, and I said, what? So, but it made great pictures, and they had a lot of fans. But then I found out later that was a very popular show. I photographed Bieber, you know, Katy Perry, so many other different artists. And I mean, the interesting challenge is trying to get the best images. And also, it's trying to not necessarily take no for an answer. One of the most interesting times was when I had an assignment to photograph Bob Dylan at the Marcus Amphitheater. And the day before, I was there photographing John Legend, you know, who was performing it the day. And we were told by the media that Mr. Dylan has very strict requirements. One, no photographs. Two, no jumbotrons, so anyone in the cheap seats won't be able to see him. And three, they said, Mr. Dylan requires that Willie Nelson, the Worm of Act, be off the stage and in his trailer before he will set foot on stage. And the last requirement was, maybe four, was that all the technicians, people on the stage, have to sign an agreement that they will not look at him in the eye. So I'm thinking, I've been covering Summerfest, I want to get Dylan, he's the one show I can't shoot, doesn't allow anything. And I thought, you know, I grew up with Dylan, I loved his music, and I'll, you know, borrow another phrase from the 60s, by any means necessary. So I was sitting photographing Legend, and I looked beyond him, and I noticed there's the Hone Bridge, about a third, maybe a quarter mile, maybe an eighth of a mile away, and there was a nice angle from the top of the Hone Bridge. So I went and got permission from the Milwaukee County Sheriff, an escort, and went up on top of the Hone Bridge with a 600mm lens, a 2X extender, and shot the first 20 songs of Bob Dylan from the bridge. And made some amazing pictures. We had some of the newer cameras, got a nice shot of the thing, but we ran them the next day, transmitted right from the bridge. And it had an amazing response. I think some of the people were saying that, no, you'll never be able to do another Dylan concert. So I said, well, I think it was too important an event to not cover. So you kind of do extraordinary things to get the images you need, you know. So
weren't you scared when you were on top of the Hone Bridge taking pictures?
No, I love, the more of a challenge, the better. Are you kidding? No. Although the one problem was the bridge was vibrating because trucks were driving over it, so it was bouncing a little bit, so I had to kind of pick my angles and look for that. But no, it's always, hey, anything that gets a great image, I'm all for taking a little chance, you know.
You are incredibly brave. As someone who is afraid of heights, I don't know that I would necessarily take that risk or be comfortable doing it, but I'm glad we have you to do that.
Well, there's a good core of photographers that cover a lot of the shows, and some of the stages are more interesting. But you plan it well. You know where to shoot. We try not to step over each other's feet. You certainly don't want to interfere with the artists. But surprisingly, sometimes the artists have done some interesting things. I remember a couple of years ago, Bon Jovi was performing on the stage, and one of my friends was right next to me in a pit photographing me at a wide angle, and he was leaning over looking right at us, and, you know, we're snapping away. And then he grabs my friend's camera, and he turns around and takes a selfie with the camera of he and the other photographer, which was like, I thought, wow, that was a sweet moment. The most amazing thing at one of the shows was where I was photographing the Rolling Stones, and we did our first two songs, got back the trailer, and I was trying to work on a tight deadline. The show was at 9:30, and we were supposed to have pictures by 10. So it's a tight deadline. So I'm starting to edit three or four pictures, and then I get the manager comes back and says, Buddy Guy is going to be going on with Stones in two more songs. You're going to let you come in for one more song. So I had to move all the deadlines back, go down there, and escort me right down to the front. And I got some amazing shots of Buddy Guy and Keith Richards jamming, and I got Mick Jagger playing the harmonica, and I got a nice hug at the end. So those nice moments, so that was one of the special moments from seeing just an awesome performance and a legendary band. So I think I'm privileged to be able to kind of be the eyes and ears for a lot of the readers that enjoy that show.
Rick's photos from the Rolling Stones concert have had an incredible reach. His picture of the band with Buddy Guy made it all the way to rollingstone.com. To see more of Rick's photos and to keep up with our Summerfest coverage, visit jsonline.com/summerfest. Coming up soon, if you're a Milwaukee Bucks fan, you were in for quite a ride Thursday night. Our sports guys have the latest on the NBA draft. But first, how do you get neighborhoods to grow? How do you attract more businesses to them? And once you have the businesses, how do you attract customers to them? Business writer Agnel Philip has one possible answer.
My story, essentially what I tried to focus on, was to see how efforts to improve Milwaukee's bike and pedestrian infrastructure was connected to efforts to redevelop Milwaukee in general, and specifically the downtown area and the areas around downtown, and how this idea of walkability and bikeability either helps or harms development.
And the neighborhood you focus on really is the Third Ward.
Mm-hmm.
Could you tell me a little bit about how walkability and bikeability has reshaped the Third Ward?
Yeah, so when I interviewed the urban planner at UWM, he took me on a bike ride using bubbler bikes, and the place he took me to was the Third Ward. And the Third Ward, according to him, has really been able to redevelop in the way it has to this point because it's built at what he called pedestrian scale, in that the blocks are pretty small, the sidewalks are wide, you don't have four lanes of traffic going through much of the area, so people can feel safe, particularly walking around, but even biking, because they've added bike lanes. And he says that that in many ways was a catalyst for the success of smaller businesses in that area, boutiques, the coffee shops, the public market, things like that.
Are there any other neighborhoods that are looking to develop in a similar way?
I know that there are some efforts to make the north side of downtown, or just north of downtown, more walkable and bike-friendly. He didn't make it into the piece, but I talked to Alderman Nick Kovac, who has that area, and that's a priority for him. And I know that there's a lot of focus there because there are a lot of people living in that area, and it's the same kind of recipe as the Third Ward, that you have a lot of people living in a concentrated area, so it makes that infrastructure more necessary.
How is this change significant for local businesses?
There's two sides of it. There is a general sense that if you take away parking spaces, you can impact your business, but the urban planner I talked to said that studies that have been done have shown that there's not really an effect by taking away parking spaces to improve bike infrastructure, and you know, there's plenty of potential for people who are walking to somewhere, biking to somewhere, to spend just as much, if not more, than somebody who drives there.
So what made that idea take off in the Third Ward?
When they were redeveloping the area in the 90s, this was something they emphasized because they wanted people to move into the spaces above the ground level retail spaces. So it's just a general thing in urban planning. If you have an area with a lot of residents, you want to make the area around it comfortable for them to feel like they can walk, get out, walk, or bike to wherever they need to. And you want to have all those amenities in that area. So I think when they were going about redeveloping the Third Ward, that was kind of a case or a pilot study in terms of looking at, you know, how can we improve the walkability, bikeability, and overall livability of that area.
Milwaukee has a pretty car-centric culture, falling behind other Midwestern cities, including Chicago and Minneapolis. If you're interested in finding out more about walkability, you can find Agnel's story at jsonline.com/business. It was a busy week politically. The Supreme Court ruled on gay marriage and Obamacare. And in Wisconsin, the stalemate over the budget continued. Another topic in the news was the debate over the Confederate flag. Our JS on Politics team weighed in on the subject, Here's editor Greg Borowski talking to reporter Craig Gilbert about Governor Scott Walker's reaction. Later, Greg is joined by columnists Kristen Snyder and James Causey for their take on the controversy.
All right, let me ask you briefly on one of the news events from this past week, of course, was the shooting in Charleston, South Carolina. From a political perspective, you know, the governor's taken some criticism for being a little, you know, hesitant perhaps to come out and say what he would do about the Confederate battle flag in South Carolina, deferring to the governor there. South Carolina is an early primary state. How do you think he handled that as just from a political standpoint?
I don't think he handled it great. I don't think he handled it terribly. He was, I think, very, very cautious, like most of the other candidates in the Republican field, who were all kind of looking for cover from Governor Haley of South Carolina. And so they were very reluctant to wade into this issue. I was with Governor Walker Saturday night in D.C., when he gave a speech to the Faith and Freedom Coalition, and he led that speech with some remarks about the shootings. But in a gaggle with reporters afterwards, he repeatedly deferred on the question of the flag. He wouldn't even talk about the flag as a symbol. He wouldn't talk about what should be done with the flag. He said there will be a debate about that. And he said that basically people in South Carolina had asked him to refrain from commenting on that until some time had passed. And then it really wasn't a whole lot of time that passed. It was basically 2 days that Governor Haley came out with her announcement. And right on the heels of that, Governor Walker endorsed it and then today said that that was his position all along. So I think, you know, that's going to obviously invite some natural cynicism when Governor Walker is saying it was always his position to take down the flag, but he couldn't speak about it until Governor Haley spoke about it. But he kind of shared that caution with a lot of other candidates in the Republican field.
All right. Well, we're going to have a little more discussion about that coming up next on our show. So thank you, Craig, and we'll talk to you again soon.
Great.
All right, we're back live now. I'm joined by opinion columnist James Causey on my left, appropriately enough, and Christian Schneider on my right. I've got my red and blue tie on, so I'm kind of officially in the middle. Christian, you heard what Craig Gilbert was saying about the South Carolina, the flag, and how the governor responded. What was your take on how the governor did, just from a political standpoint, in his response?
Yeah, I mean, I think he pretty much took a knee right off the bat, which, you know, a lot of the candidates did, and now he said, as Craig just told you, that you know, Governor Haley told him to not comment so she could come out and make her big announcement. You know, a lot of people, I think, on this issue, flag or no flag, you know, anytime a big emotional thing like this happens, they wonder, you know, what can we really do? Like, what do we do about this? And I think the public right now is like, well, you know, gun control, maybe that would have made a difference, maybe it wouldn't have, but hey, there's this flag thing out there. So they go ahead and they do the flag, and you know, in the end, I think James had it right in his column. I mean, it's gone, and that's good, and I think a lot of people are for that. But in the end, what difference is it really going to make?
Well, James, staying with Walker for a minute, mm-hmm. I mean, what was your take on his response? He didn't immediately come out and say this is a bad thing on the flag. He did make some strong statements about the racism involved in the shooting in Charleston. But what was your?
I think he played it a little bit too safe. I, you know, for a leadership, I would have liked to see him be more aggressive. I understand that he was, you know, as Christian said, taking a knee. But you want leadership. This is a guy that's about to enter the presidential race. So it wouldn't have hurt him to just come out and say, no, it's wrong. And it needs to come down. But there's so much more to be done. I mean, there's roads and streets named after Confederate generals and things like that right there in that area. So the flag is one thing, but it's so much more that needs to be done.
Well, why do those things remain, I mean, important? I mean, symbolically, it's a big change, obviously, to do it. But where, I mean, to make all these changes, the flag, I mean, why are those things so important?
Why shouldn't it be important? I mean, the rebel flag has been known as to African Americans been a symbol of oppression for decades, and it goes back as far as I mentioned in my column. I didn't understand it at first. I remember I used to watch the Dukes of Hazzard like most of us did.
I was never allowed to watch it.
Like most of us did, and we saw the Confederate flag on the General Lee, and it was like, it was cool, this car doing all these jumps and things like that. But I didn't really truly understand it until my grandfather in the South in Mississippi took me around and I saw all these Confederate flags and white business windows and establishments like that, and I never saw African-American showing the flag. And it helped me understand exactly what it meant. So it's deep. It's deeper than just a flag. It goes, it's deep in our roots, and it needs to be addressed.
If you're interested in watching the full JS on Politics show, you can find that online at jsonline.com/politics. The show is available as a podcast as well. You can download the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher Radio. And finally, whether you thought the Bucks made wise moves or not, Thursday night's NBA draft was an interesting one to watch. Here's Matt Velasquez and beat writer Charles F. Gardner with more.
After surprising many with a trip to the playoffs this past season, the Milwaukee Bucks entered Thursday's NBA draft looking to add some quality pieces to their young roster. They opted to bring in a pair of shooters, taking UNLV's Rashad Vaughn with the 17th overall pick, and trading the 46th pick and a future first-rounder to Toronto for veteran guard Grievous Vasquez. Bucks beat reporter Charles F. Gardner covered the action on Thursday night at the Bucks practice facility. Charles, how do you assess the Bucks' moves on draft night?
Well, I think the selection of Rashad Vaughn was a good one. He obviously shot up the draft boards at the end of the draft process of the workouts. We saw him on Monday at the and he was kind of a surprise entrant, I guess you would say, for the Bucks draft, the final workout. And he's a good shooter. He's a freshman. He's one of the youngest players in the draft, second youngest, 18 years old. But the Bucks saw a lot in him. I asked John Hammond if it was the Golden State factor, because we've seen how those guys can shoot the ball with the Splash Brothers and how that made it such an impact in the NBA this year. And it's true that many NBA teams are looking for shooters. Could they get the next Steph Curry? Could they get the next Klay Thompson? Everybody would like to have one of those guys. And whether Rashad Vaughn will be that, hard to tell. But he showed enough that he really caught the Bucks' eye. He has the body. John Hammond said tonight he has a prototypical two-guard body in the NBA, 6'6", and you know, he has some bulk to him, and he really can shoot the ball. So it'll probably take some time for him, but again, another young player, but a guy the Bucks feel that can be part of this new NBA. The Bucks needed some shooting. John Hammond said, "What was the first thing I talked about in the last month? Shooting." And I think that's where Grievous Vasquez comes in, too, because I've seen him shoot the lights out against the Bucks. There was a game a few years ago where he was 10 for 15 and 6 for 8 from three-point range against the Bucks. And he's also a point guard, so they were looking for a backup point guard, somebody, a little more veteran player to come in behind Michael Carter-Williams. And I think that's a good move. The interesting part of that is that they gave up a 2017 first-round pick, and some of the experts who talk about the draft felt maybe that was a bit much to give up for Vasquez, and that may be determined in the future. Hard to tell. But again, that was the Clippers pick they got last year in the Jared Dudley deal, and so it was a protected pick, so it was not going to be a high first-round pick in 2017. It was likely going to be in the 20s or lower. So I think the Bucks are thinking, hey, let's see what we can do now to help our depth and our shooting.
You know, and outside of the Bucks, there were four players with some local ties that got picked in this year's draft. You know, the first two of those local guys who came off the board were both University of Wisconsin stars, Frank Kaminsky and Sam Decker. You know, Kaminsky went 9th to Charlotte, and Decker went 18th to Houston. You know, how do you assess where they landed?
Well, I think they both did very well. I mean, Frank Kaminsky, the talk on draft day all day on Thursday was that he was moving up, that liked him at 4, but they didn't know if they could take him at 4. So, and the talk was that he would not land lower than Charlotte at number 9, and that proved to be true. There was some talk about Charlotte possibly trading the pick, but they did not. They kept it. They took Frank. And, you know, I think he will be a good fit there. The kind of funny part of it was that he grew up watching Michael Jordan, and now he's going to be playing for Michael Jordan. He talked about that when he was interviewed at the draft in New York. So a very good spot for him going in the top 10. And I think he said, hey, I'm so excited that I went in the top 10. That was an achievement for him, I think. Sam Decker, I think, of the great fit in Houston. You know, a team that really surprised this year. James Harden, I don't know if they surprised. They've maybe fulfilled their potential a little more, where you had Dwight Howard, James Harden. He could fit in there as somebody who is a shooter, small forward. I think that's a real nice fit for him. John Hammond was asked why the Bucks maybe passed on him, taking Vaughn at 17, Decker was 18. But again, John Hammond talked about how they have Jabari Parker, they have Giannis Antetokounmpo, so they have some people at that position, and they were looking for a little bit of a different need. And he said, you know, he thinks he will fit. It'll be a great fit with the Houston Rockets.
Well, that does it for this week. Thanks again for joining us. Tune in next week as we take a look back at this year's Summerfest with music writer Piet Levy.